Hi, this is Alan Chartok. With us today is an old friend, Dr. Stephen M. Burke, Henry and Sally Schaefer Professor of Holocaust and Jewish Studies and Professor of History at Union College in Schenectady, New York. Dr. Burke is the former chair of the Department of History, director of the program in Russian and Eastern European Studies, and faculty advisor to the Jewish Student Organization. He's the author of Year of Crisis, Year of Hope, Russian Jewry and the Pogroms of 1881 to 1882. Professor Burke is writing a new book entitled Our People Are Your People, American Jewry and the Struggle for Civil Rights, 1954 to 1965. The book provides an interesting discussion of an extremely important chapter in the history of the civil rights movement and attempts to dispel the myths and misunderstanding that surround the black-Jewish relationship. I'm going to want to talk about that in this interview. Professor Burke has been a consultant to the Wiesenthal Holocaust Center in Los Angeles and in 1992 made a set of 6-hour-long audio tape lectures on the Holocaust that have been sold across the country. Professor Burke has written articles on Russian and Jewish history, anti-Semitism, and the Middle East, is lectured on throughout the United States and Canada, including such distinguished colleges and universities as Princeton, Vanderbilt, the University of Texas at Austin, and Williams College. Professor Burke is frequently consulted by newspaper reporters and by television and radio stations, including the BBC. 2 college guidebooks mention Professor Burke as the best teacher at Union College. In 1996, Professor Burke received the prestigious Holocaust Memorial Award from the Holocaust Survivors and Friends Education Center. The citation accompanying the award stated, "On the 50th anniversary of the end of the Nuremberg trials, the Holocaust Memorial Award honors Dr. Burke's years of dedication to understanding and education as a worldwide lecturer and spellbinding speaker on the lessons of the Holocaust and its meanings for today." And in 2010, Professor Burke was designated an Israel Hero for his defense and advocacy of the State of Israel by JERNY Journey, the Jewish Educational Resources of New York. Professor Burke has also won the prestigious Academic Citizens Laureate awarded by the University at Albany Foundation in 2013. Welcome, Professor Stephen Burke. Always great to have you back here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with a very easy question, Steve. Israel is under tremendous pressure across the political spectrum for holding out and for not making peace. Are they being intransigent?
I don't think so. I think the issues are very, very complex. To really get right to the nitty-gritty here, the Palestinians have a legitimate right for self-determination. I don't think any decent person in Israel or outside of Israel would object to that. The issue is, how do you balance the justified claims of self-determination on the part of the Palestinians with the need of Israel for security? That really is the basic issue. The anti-Semitism within the Islamic world, particularly the Middle East in the Islamic world, is absolutely ferocious. I mean, I teach history, for example, and one thing I will never tell my students is what Hamas says on its radio broadcasts, and that is that Jews, not Israel, not Zionists, Jews are responsible for the French Revolution of 1789, the revolutions of 1848, the Bolshevik Revolution that brought the communists to power, World War I and World War II can be attributed to the Jews. It's hard. In fact, let me put it to you this way. The anti-Semitism that is expressed in the Middle East Islamic world is very comparable, I also teach the Holocaust, to what Adolf Hitler was saying about the Jews before 1939. Hamas does not recognize the State of Israel. It talks about, for example, the creation of a Palestinian state between the river and the sea. And geographically, that means, of course, the destruction of the State of Israel. So the issue for Israel is, how do you guarantee, if Israel withdraws from the West Bank, acquiesces in the creation of a Palestinian state, who's going to make sure that the rockets don't fly? Who's going to stop it? Can Abbas do it? Can Fatah do it? There are elements in Fatah, his organization, that, of course, really want to destroy the State of Israel as well. So it is not an easy thing. And the distances, as everybody should know, are very short, are very small. The distance, for example, between Kfar Saba within the Green Line and Qalqilya on the other side of the Green Line, it's 100 yards, if it is that. That's really the issue. And for Israelis who withdrew from southern Lebanon, and what did they get in return? Hezbollah and, of course, the rockets coming into northern Israel. And then, of course, they withdrew from Gaza. And what did they get? The rockets fall on their road in Ashkelon and Ashdod. So intransigence, I think, is the wrong word for here. Any Israeli government will be concerned with security. There are people who say that Israel must take risks. What country takes risks? When did the United States ever take a risk? So the question here is, I think, I'm a two-state person. I believe that Israel has to eventually relinquish most of the West Bank, has to withdraw from most of the settlements. There should be a Palestinian state. But unless Israeli security is guaranteed, unless that security is guaranteed, if the Israelis have to hold on, then they have to hold on. And one of the problems, of course, is it's not only two states. Most Israelis are prepared to accept, acquiesce in the creation of a two-state solution. The problem is on the other side. Abbas said he's from Sfat. He's a refugee from Sfat. And he said, I don't want to settle in Sfat, meaning that the Palestinians, implying that the Palestinians don't want to go back. He was excoriated in the Palestinian and the Arab press for saying that, and he never said it again. The Israeli governments, no matter how were they right or the left, prepared the Israeli public for the creation of a Palestinian state. The Palestinians, Palestinian leaders, from Arafat on, have never told the Palestinians in nuanced language they're not going home. And as long as that issue is on the table, as long as they demand that the Palestinian people return home, then there's going to be a very, very serious problem.
So if you're Netanyahu and have to guide his country through this, he says he's a two-state person too. What do you do?
You try to work out a deal, and the deal should provide for, from the Israeli perspective, the deal should provide for a withdrawal from most of the settlements, an exchange of land, all of these things that have been talked about, and the acceptance of Israel as a Jewish state. I think Netanyahu is right on this one. Secretary of State Kerry says, well, the UN recognized Israel as a Jewish state. We recognize Israel as a Jewish state. But the Palestinians have not. And the Palestinians are the main people involved. And when one listens to what Abbas says...
Let's just get this straight. I'm sorry, Steve. The Abbas is the...
The president of the Palestinian Authority.
Okay.
The Palestine Authority.
So in other words...
He's representing the Palestinians in the negotiations.
Who are closer to us than the other faction.
Than the other faction, Hamas.
Yes.
Hamas is clear. It will not, under any circumstances, recognize the state of Israel. It is very, very clear. Hamas and Islamic Jihad... These are the two extremist organizations in the Gaza Strip. To the north in Lebanon is Hezbollah, literally the party of God. They want to destroy the state of Israel as well.
So any agreement, it doesn't matter who's representing them in the talks, any agreement has to get everybody on the table.
One would think so. One would think so, but that's the Israeli dilemma. We make an agreement with Abbas, the leader of the Palestine Authority. We make this agreement with Abbas. Can he guarantee... We know that Hamas has strength on the West Bank. Can he guarantee that if he makes a peace agreement with Israel, he's going to be able to stop Hamas from launching or lobbing rockets over against Israel?
Just on that for a second, Stephen, it would appear that since he can't get them into a coalition with him, that he could not guarantee that at all.
It would appear that he cannot guarantee that at all. Although, if one is an optimist, there has been a very close relationship between Israeli security forces and the police. And the paramilitary organizations of the Palestine Authority.
Yeah, but not of Hamas.
Not of Hamas. But there is evidence to suggest, again, the people who are very strong for the peace negotiations would say this is not a major worry because the Palestinian police have cooperated with the Israelis in thwarting terrorist attacks in the past, and they will probably do it in the future. I'm not so sure that that's right.
Why not?
Because I'm not sure they have the capability.
And well, fights with Hamas.
They have fights with Hamas. But remember...
And Hamas won.
And Hamas has won. Certainly in Gaza,
yeah.
Hamas has won. Hamas has a great deal of strength. And the problem is, I think flows from the fact that there are many, many Palestinians, if not most Palestinians, who are not prepared to relinquish the idea of returning to Israel.
Sure.
And that's a problem. No Israeli government, even one far to the left, is going to accept large numbers of Palestinians. The reason being, again, I'll use the language we were talking about this before, that my students probably are not familiar with, but older people are, that is from the Israeli perspective, they would constitute a fifth column within the state of Israel, a subversive element, and the Jewish character of the state would be destroyed. So that's the problem.
Now, there is somebody out there listening to this radio show who is going to say, but wait a second, they were expelled from their own country.
Again, if we want to get right to the substance here.
Well, I'd rather do that than not.
Right. 750,000 Palestinians fled the area
during
1948 and late 47, 48 and early 49. Some were forced out. Some fled because they did the only sane thing that civilians ever do in a war, get the devil out of the line of fire. And others, we think, were told by emissaries coming from various Arab states and really had to leave. But I must tell you, again, it was a catastrophe. Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. It was a catastrophe. But I am of the opinion, and I think most Israelis are of the opinion, this need not have happened. That is, on November 29th of 1947, the United Nations General Assembly voted for Resolution 181, partitioning Palestine west of the River Jordan into a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Zionist movement accepted it. The Palestinian leadership in the Arab world rejected it. Sometimes a people make a mistake, or their leaders make a mistake, and the mistake is almost irrevocable. Again, forgive me for spitting this out.
And in this case, it was the Arab mistake.
It was a terrible Arab mistake. If the Arabs had accepted Resolution 181, there would not be a war in 48. There would not be those refugees fleeing. And, put it another way, in a positive sense, we would be celebrating not only the 66th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel, we'd be celebrating the 66th anniversary of the creation of the State of Palestine.
Stephen Burke, in order to get this thing done, a deal, which obviously Secretary Kerry really wants to get done, President Obama really wants to get done, there's lip service from some Arab leaders, there's lip service from Netanyahu. What will they have to give up of what they've got of the Israelis?
The Israelis are going to have to, again, agree to a Palestinian state and withdraw from most of the settlements. That is already agreed upon. There's no debate on that.
So they're building all this stuff. People think provocatively.
Art.
Yeah, arguably, whatever.
Art.
And then you're going to have to say to your people, give up your homes, give up your stuff, and go out.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, the proposals that are on and seem to have been agreed upon is that Israel would withdraw from 20% of the settlements. These are outlying small settlements that the Israeli government, even the conservative government, even Netanyahu has agreed, these are illegal settlements. They'll withdraw from those, consolidate them into such large settlements, for example, as Maale Adumim, which is really a little city now. That will take place. There'll be an exchange of territory. But the things get sticky. One, on the issue of the refugees. What do you do about Jerusalem, for example?
I want to hear about that. Let's stop on that for a moment, because there's a concept that this would be an open city, two rulers.
You can make it an open city. Now, I must tell you, I get into trouble sometimes by saying this.
With who?
with some supporters of Israel. With some supporters of Israel.
Okay.
I know all the arguments for why Israel should keep all of Jerusalem. I know those arguments. They are correct arguments. It is only Israel that has guaranteed full access, free access, to all of the holy places. No discrimination. People are not beaten up as they were before 1948 when Jews wanted to pray at the wall. Some of them were slaughtered. Some of them were beaten up, and so on. Israel has protected the holy places of all of the religions. That's an argument in terms of Israel holding on to all of it. In addition, Jerusalem is far holier to the Jews than it is to Islam. Mecca and Medina are the major places. Jerusalem was not a major place for the Arabs, really probably until the coming of Zionism. So the point here is, again, Israel has the right, the moral right, the religious right to hold on to the old city of Jerusalem. Where I get into trouble is when I say there'll never be peace between Israel and the Islamic world, certainly Israel and the Arab world, unless there is a Palestinian presence in Jerusalem.
Is there a way to do it?
I think there is a way to do it, but it becomes very, very difficult.
United Nations, what happens?
The United Nations can do it, but I must tell you, the United Nations, ever since the issues in Bosnia and the Yugoslavian crisis, the United Nations just doesn't have a good deal of credibility, certainly not in Israel, and I myself don't believe much in the United Nations in the sense that it is an effective deterrent to violence. For anybody who follows these events, the name Srebrenica should mean something. There was a Dutch NATO force. Dutch NATO force leaves the area because it is threatened by the Serbs, and what takes place is a slaughter of Muslims. So the idea of the UN being a guarantor is not a particularly strong one as far as Israel is concerned. And the UN's behavior, for example, in southern Lebanon under the UN Resolution 1701, where it was supposed to disarm Hezbollah and other militia groups, they have done nothing of that. So that's a problem. That
well,
is a very serious
any other
problem.
Plan besides the UN?
Well, there is a plan to put American forces in there. As an American, I would strongly oppose this. As a Jewish American, I would most particularly oppose it. People are going to get killed there. And I don't want American soldiers getting killed. I don't want them because I'm an American, and I don't want them because I'm a supporter of Israel as well. Because, sure enough, if American soldiers are killed there, somebody's going to say, well, they're dying for the Jews, they're dying for Israel. So that's the problem. Who do you put in there? Could you put in a NATO force? Maybe. Of course, the Israeli argument is, which is not accepted by the Palestinians, is that in these key areas, not only in Jerusalem, but in the Jordan Valley, for example, only Israel has to remain in the Jordan Valley, for example, to make sure that terrorists don't come from Iraq and don't come from other places. The Palestinians refuse to accept that. That's one of the stumbling blocks. It's not only the settlements, it's not only the refugees, it's Jerusalem, and it is security.
Is it doable?
I think it's doable. Is it probable? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Why is there this huge group of people who are just willing to blame Israel and not to look at the other side that you have so forcefully laid out?
There are a number of reasons for this. One is, it's in some cases, it's old-fashioned anti-Semitism. They're people that do not like Jews, both certainly in the Islamic world and outside of the Islamic world.
And they deny that. They always say, well,
it's
Israel.
No, yeah, look. Some of it is just plain stupidity.
Yeah.
For example, one of the dumbest statements that I have ever heard came from this guy, I think he was the president of the American Scholars Association, that condemned Israel.
Yeah.
And what does he say? It was pointed out to him, look, if you want to condemn anybody, look what China does in Tibet. Look what the Chinese do to intellectuals and university professors. Look what the Russians have done to Chechnya. People disappear in Russia, and you are not raising anything. You're not saying anything about this. And this foolish statement was, we had to start somewhere. That's just major league dumb, if you want to take a benign interpretation of this. When you look around and see so much evil that is taking place in the world, and who do they single out? They single out Israel. It's either stupidity or it's anti-Semitism. Now, in addition to that, there are people who look at this from a Marxist or a pseudo-Marxist perspective. They look upon Israel as an imperialist nation, and if you hate the United States, you hate Israel. You just hate Israel. Israel is supported by the United States. In the eyes of these people, is the United States is an imperialist conqueror. It dominates the entire world and does all these terrible things. So I think some of that comes into play. In Europe, there is so much now a revulsion against European imperialism. For example, in Paris and France now, you're getting these guys in their late 80s and 90s who served in Algeria. And now they're coming clean, talking about all the terrible things they did. And in effect, what they're really saying is, we did these terrible things in the name of European imperialism. We've got to make things right, and we'll make things right by supporting the Arabs. So it's a combination of, I think, left-wing politics, anti-Semitism, and just plain stupidity, and also, to a certain extent, cowardice. And that is, for example, I think one of the Asian studies organizations has also condemned Israel. Now, how an Asian studies organization can remain silent over what the Chinese are doing, again, at Tibetans and also to intellectuals, a number of poets and so on, that's just sheer cowardice. They know that if they publicly condemn China, they'll never have access again. It's the same thing with Soviet scholars back in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And that is, many of them refused to condemn the Soviet Union. They'd never get entrance again.
The Soviets were for endorsing the State of Israel in the beginning.
That is correct.
But they switched. What happened there?
They were able to count, like the British were able to count at the end of the 1930s.
Right.
The Soviet policy was very strong. That's one of the more interesting questions in international relations. If you were to listen to Soviet delegates at the UN, you would think you're listening to Abba Ibn, the most articulate of the Israeli representatives and the Israeli representative to the UN. They supported Zionism and so on. And in fact, in 1948, without the aid that was provided from Czechoslovakia at the prodding of the Soviet Union, Israel would not have won that war. Most historians now believe that. We think that Stalin, let me put it this way, to lighten this up a little bit. Golda Meir was a very sharp person. But one of the less sharp remarks she ever made was something to the effect that Stalin felt bad about how the Jews had suffered during the Second World War. Stalin didn't feel bad about anything that happened to the Jews. He didn't feel bad about anything that happened. He didn't feel about anything about it. This is a man that murdered millions upon millions of people.
Sure.
We think that Stalin believed, mistakenly, that Ben-Gurion and the socialist movement, which was the dominant for years, for decades in Israel, that they would be sympathetic to the Soviet Union and that this would be a Soviet base in the Middle East. Stalin also wanted the British out of the Middle East. Eventually, they learned that that's not going to be the case. Ben-Gurion was an anti-communist. Ben-Gurion saw the American Jewish diaspora as being the key and America as being the key to Israeli survival. So he wasn't going to go along with this. Some historians and political scientists argue that the turning point comes in June of 1950 when Israel votes with the United States. against North Korea. Yeah. In any event, by the early 50s, the Soviet line has changed. The Soviets become strong supporters of the Arab side against Israel.
There are so many places I want to go, but let me ask you this. You're a Holocaust scholar. The Holocaust becomes an important underpinning for the justification of the state of Israel, right?
Right and wrong.
Okay.
Let me say, this is one of the mistakes that President Obama made when he went to Cairo. He got up there and made a statement that some American Jews thought was the best thing since sliced bread. He articulately laid out to the Arab world through Cairo, through the Egyptian parliament, and he said that the Jews have suffered, and they suffered terribly in the Holocaust, and that really justifies their claim to Israel. Now, to a certain extent, that's true. But as any student who even has the most cursory knowledge of Jewish history knows, that's the land of David and Solomon. That's the land of the prophets. That's the land of the two temples. That's the land where the Jewish people entered history and made those great contributions to history. That's what they did there. The Jewish claim to what in Hebrew is called Eretz Yisrael antedates the Holocaust by over 2,000 years. So you can talk about the Holocaust. The mistake President Obama made was that he played into the hands of more sophisticated anti-Israeli sentiment within the Middle East. Now, there were idiots like Ahmadinejad who said the Holocaust never took place.
Sure.
No, that was just stupid.
Dismissed.
That was dismissed.
Yeah.
But there were people in the Arab world who said, yes, the Holocaust did take place. And 6 million Jews did, in fact, die. But we didn't do it. We didn't kill them. So why did you inflict Israel upon us? So if you justify Israel only by the Holocaust, you're on somewhat weak grounds. What he should have said is, the people have a claim to this land because of the long history in that land, and they would have remained in that land had they not been expelled by the Romans twice, and had they not come under great pressure by Arab conquerors who made an incentive to convert to Islam. That's what he should have said.
John Stesinger, who was my professor at Hunter, I don't know if you remember his work, but
yes.
Wrote a book, got the Bancroft Prize, and his major thesis was, if the Arabs didn't have the common hatred of Israel, they would certainly kill each other. What do you think of that?
I think he was right. You were taught well. He was a very distinguished political scientist. I think he's absolutely right. Look what we have seen. The fight between Shiites and Sunnis, the fighting in Lebanon, the fighting in Iraq, the fighting between Arabs and Persians or Iranians. I think he has got it right. And again, the conflict between the rich and the poor, the secularists and the Islamic extremists, there's a good deal of internal strife within the Islamic world, which is why I thought it was wrong for a number of political scientists and a number of American politicians and a number of people in the State Department to say, if you solve the Arab-Israeli dispute, the Middle East will become tranquil, it will become quiescent.
Did you really say that?
There are people who said that. That's absolutely right. Now, the Arab-Israeli dispute is important, but if Israel, unfortunately, if somehow Israel was not there, I think Stesinger is right, a number of Arabs would devour each other.
Talk to us about, Stephen Berg, talk to us about settlements. We touched on it before, but I want to talk to you now about this. There are those people who say, hey, why do you keep building more?
If it were me, I wouldn't be building more.
You would not.
I would not be building more. But most of it flows from the political character of the state of Israel. Israel has a system, a political system that runs on proportional representation. You get a certain percentage of the vote,
sure.
You get a certain percentage of the seats in the Knesset. No Israeli political party since 1948 has ever won a majority, which means every government in Israel is a coalition government. One doesn't have to be a wizard of political science to understand it's not easy to make decisions. In this case, Netanyahu is a center, let's say right of center, right government. If he doesn't approve the building of settlements, his government is gone. It is as simple as that. That's been a problem. Now, underneath it all, there was the euphoria that came out of the Six-Day War. Everybody talks about religious enthusiasm in the Islamic world. There was a great deal of religious enthusiasm in Israel after 1967. This remarkable victory, 6 days, preceded by a great deal of fear. Israel is going to be destroyed. For those who look at the world through the prism of religion, this was divine intervention. This is the beginning of redemption, the beginning of the Messianic age. And some of these people actually thought that, or were of the belief, and some continue to believe this, God gave us this land, and no government in Israel can relinquish what God gave to us. So the euphoria, the religious enthusiasm led to the settlements on the West Bank. It is often forgotten, however, that it is left-wing governments that began the settlements. They began the settlements not out of religious fervor, but because of a belief that those settlements could be defensive blocks that would protect Israel from a war of revenge or from renewed attacks.
Okay, fair enough. But somebody's listening right now and throwing books at the radio and saying, but ask him why they have to keep asking for more. Is it always more defense?
No, it's not defense anymore. No, it's not defense. It is, again, these people, extreme nationalists in Israel, believe this is part of the Israeli heritage, or the Jewish heritage, the Jewish patrimony. It's our land. It should be given to us. Some are religiously motivated. And I think Netanyahu is not a religious man.
Yeah.
Netanyahu is not a religious man. Netanyahu, in order to keep his government intact, in order that the coalition does not dissolve, in order, in fact, to engage in peace negotiations, in order to release prisoners to the Palestinians, must cater to the right wing of his coalition.
Okay,
and that is what he's doing.
Let's talk to Stephen Burke, because, of course, my family's been back and forth to Israel a lot. You know, my wife is a Holocaust scholar, as you are. And my wife has a cousin who's a right-winger. I think I could tell you that. She also has an ex-boyfriend who is anything but during that thing. So there is a sort of schism.
There certainly is.
In Israel. And that schism seems to be showing some subtle movement in which the Orthodox contingent, for example, are being asked to supply their kids to fight in the same way that other people are. And that seems to be a bone of real contention. It hasn't happened yet, but there does seem to be this huge movement.
All right, but that's a different issue, Alan.
No, but we're dealing with the same two groups.
Not necessarily. Again, you have to divide the Orthodox community.
Sure, sure.
There are more modern Orthodox than the ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah.
It's the ultra-Orthodox that do not serve. Modern Orthodox people have always served
right. In
the Israel Defense Forces. The ultra-Orthodox not only do not serve, many of them do not even recognize the existence of the State of Israel. So you are quite right. The issue is the burden should be shared. These people are living in the country. They're receiving, in many cases, a lot of them are receiving social welfare benefits. They don't work. Many of the men don't work.
They're studying Torah.
And they don't serve. Many of them don't serve. And their numbers are growing because they have large numbers of children. And so the issue has become, how can Israel survive without everybody sharing the burden? And so with the election of Yair Lapid, a more secular person playing a major role now in Netanyahu's coalition, the government is now moving to address this issue. But it is a very, very divisive issue.
Will it happen in our lifetime?
I think it will. I think if only because many of the ultra-Orthodox community, at least on one level, are coming to understand that I don't think they care much about that being a burden on the state, but the fact that you're not training people to make a living in this world is going to be a tremendous burden on them. It dooms large numbers of ultra-Orthodox families to a marginal economic existence.
Stephen Burke, is it a myth that those ultra-Orthodox people have been among those who have insisted on not making peace with the Arabs?
I think it is a myth. Some of them don't give a damn. There are some people, again, who take that position, this is God's land. Usually the ultra-Orthodox have articulated one primary demand. One, that their young men do not go into service. Two, that they continue to get social welfare benefits. And three, that the country continues to run, that they have an important hold on certain basic elements of the religion and family life and personal life within the State of Israel. And they want support for their schools. You give them that, that's their primary concern.
But I guess, as inarticulate as I may be about this, I want to know whether those people, the ultra-Orthodox, who make those demands that you've just ticked off, are amongst those who think that the other people's kids really should go and fight for Israel hard to preserve what is now Israel.
That they believe that. But of course, underneath that is a belief that they are doing as great a service for the defense of the Jewish people as are the men and women in the Israel Defense Force.
Because they're studying.
They're studying Torah. Now, that gets you into a theological debate. The rabbis have talked about this. Maimonides, probably the greatest thinker in all of Jewish history, said, you study, but you also work.
Talk to us a little bit about the way in which Israel has to deal with the rest of the world. What should they do? I mean, you have this group, this major group, who have come out and said, you know, you're wrong for all the reasons you say that you have problems with it, me too. But what does Israel do now?
It would be probably best for Israel or an Israeli government to stop new settlements. That probably would enhance the Israeli image. Also, it wouldn't be the most desirable thing. In a perfect world, one ought not to do this. But the Israelis may, because they are coming under great pressure, if they cannot get an agreement with Abbas to make a unilateral withdrawal, that Israel will decide when it will do it and where the borders will be.
From the West Bank.
From the West Bank. They have already withdrawn from Gaza. It's not an ideal situation. It's much better if there would be an agreement with Hamas, because it would give it more legitimacy. But if the Israelis could get out of there, it would be a good thing. Now, I must tell you here, there is a role for President Obama and for the leaders of the European Union, and they have not stepped up into that role. Obama's got to do two things. President Obama has got to do two things, and the members of the EU have got to do it. They've got to make two visits. They've got to go to Jerusalem, and they've got to go to Ramallah, the capital, the temporary capital of the Palestine Authority. In Israel, President Obama has got to say to the Israelis, we're with you, we've got your back, but you know, you really ought not to build any more settlements. When he does that, he gives Netanyahu cover, because Netanyahu can then go to the Israeli public and say, look, I'm the son of the old man, his father died about 103, who is a zealot revisionist. That means he wanted it all. He says, you know me, you know my heart, it belongs to us. But the Americans, our greatest ally, will not allow it. So we've got to...
But every time, I'm sorry, Stephen, but every single time the Americans have let it, the perception is that Netanyahu thumbs his nose at the United States.
Obama, who is not trusted in Israel, has got to go to the Knesset and say that. Say it publicly, not say it in Washington. Mm-hmm. We support you. We will guarantee this Israeli security. And then after he does that, he gets in his limousine and he goes to Ramallah. And when he goes to Ramallah, he tells the Palestinians in nuanced language, far softer than what I said before. Mm-hmm. But essentially, he's got to tell the Palestinians, you're not going home. Forget it. You're not going home. A catastrophe took place in 48. We will compensate you billions of dollars. We will help you build a Palestinian state. But forget about going home and the conflict with Israel. What that does, Abbas can now say, or a Palestinian leader can say, look, I'm a refugee. I want to go home. We all should go home. But the Americans will not allow it.
But what happens?
You will not allow it.
Stephen, what happens to all the leaders, particularly Hamas, but also, you know, also Abbas's people, who have made their reps, their jobs, by being warriors? Can they give it up?
That's a very interesting question, and that's the argument as to why Arafat did not accept the Camp David Accords or the subsequent discussions at Taba. That is, he couldn't give up the struggle. But Abbas is not cut from that stuff. Some of the others are, but Abbas is not. Abbas is on record going back years, if not decades, for a more peaceful solution. But again, the issue has been that no Palestinian leader, the only one, believe it or not, that came close to saying that was the second President Bush, where he said, you got to accept certain facts on the ground, certain things have taken place. But the fact of the matter is, we are now here in 2014, somebody has got to say it.
Now, we have seen powerful Israelis assassinated. We've seen Sadat in Egypt assassinated. Anybody who comes close to this has a warning, has a price on his head, right?
That is correct. But that's what great leadership is all about.
Yeah, Lincoln.
That's what you do. I mean, if you want to make peace, if you want to benefit your people, you have to take certain risks. That's absolutely right. You're correct.
There are so many things I want to talk to you about, Stephen Burke. Stephen Burke, of course, is professor at Union College, distinguished historian and distinguished observer of all of this. He's been here many times. And I want to go to a couple of other areas. As long as we have you, let's talk a little bit about the Ukraine. One of the things we've been hearing is that the Ukraine is a hotbed of anti-Semitism. Is that true?
The Ukraine was a hotbed of anti-Semitism, particularly the western part of the Ukraine, particularly the city that in Ukrainian is called Lviv. That area, that's the eastern part of Galicia, it used to be part of Poland before the Second World War. That historically has been a hotbed of anti-Semitism and of Ukrainian nationalism. There was a lot of cooperation there by Ukrainians with the Nazis and dealing with murdering the Jews. Of that, there is no doubt. No one would argue against that. The question is, does it exist at the present time? There is anti-Semitism there. There is an extremist form of nationalism there. It has not been a major problem for the small numbers of Jews that live there. And President Putin's remark that we're taking the Crimea, that we are concerned about what happens in the Ukraine because of the great deal of anti-Semitism, that's it. That doesn't cut the mustard. It really isn't there. I mean, again, There had been some anti-Semitic incidents in the Ukraine, but there have been anti-Semitic incidents in Russia as well. What happened in the past, that's a terrible chapter in Ukrainian history. There is no evidence that anti-Semitism plays a major role in contemporary Ukrainian politics. There is an organization known as the Right Sector, some of it, and there are organizations even to the right of that, that on occasion have expressed anti-Semitism. But you should not use, he's wrong, but it's a common political ploy here on his part, to use anti-Semitism as a pretext for certain actions. That is in the Ukraine and so on. This is a land grab. That is what he did in the Crimea. But again, if one wants to be fair, you can have a more benign explanation of this. Is this summer 1938 or is this 19th century America? Is this comparable to what Hitler did in the Sudetenland? Or, as Moshe Arends, the former Israeli foreign minister, said, is this a Russian version of the Monroe Doctrine? That is, this is their turf. He's got a right. The Crimea should have been part of Russia. I mean, Khrushchev gave it away in 1954.
Because he was Ukrainian.
Because he was a Ukrainian. Yeah. There were a number of reasons. It didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. When the Soviet Union was there, it didn't mean anything.
Right.
Now it means something. But the Crimea is so deeply entrenched in Russian history. Tolstoy's first stories deal with the Crimea. The Crimean War, which is worth a footnote in American history, is worth a lot in Russian history. The resistance, the heroic resistance during the Second World War by people in Sevastopol, again in other places, this really resonates in the Russian psyche. And also he does it, not only, he does it to generate political support at home, that is within Russia itself.
And it's apparently very successfully already.
Apparently, it's very, very successful. And also, of course, to put pressure on the Ukrainian government to perhaps give more autonomy there, to make Russian an official language, and to create the impression that he is watching out for the Russians in what the Russians call the near abroad. But it gets sticky here. I mean, it can be very incendiary, inflammatory here. Someone shoots a gun here, provocateurs do things, and if you're living in Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia, you're quaking in your boots.
Pollard, you'd have to be naive not to think that the United States does spying in other countries, that Israel did spying here, that Pollard got caught. And there's been this constant attempt to get Pollard out of jail. He's a sick man. He's ready to be paroled anyway in another year or two. And we now know from NSA and everything else that the United States' hands aren't all that clean. What do you make of this?
There are a number of questions. You're absolutely right. The American hands are not clean there. We spy on the Israelis all the time.
Sure.
There are a number of questions that have to be asked. Question number one, was Pollard promised a deal? Some of his defense attorneys have said he was promised a deal that would be much less prison time and that the government at the last minute reneged on that deal. That's number one. The second question is he being treated unfairly? Were there people, for example, who spied for the Soviet Union? Did they receive a tough treatment, the same tough treatment that Pollard has? And then the question that nobody, that's not right. It's not right to say that nobody knows. We don't know it. The government may know it. And this may be the sticking point. Did people die as a consequence of Pollard's revelations? For example, there are people who say nobody could have suffered. After all, he was giving secrets to Israel, a friendly government. The Israelis would not reveal any information that would damage American agents. But we know that Soviet intelligence penetrated Israel. That is, the information that Pollard gave, did it in fact somehow end up in Soviet hands because, again, of Soviet espionage in Israel? And did people who work for American intelligence, did they die or were they incarcerated because of some of the things that Pollard did? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I don't think anybody outside of government knows. So I think once you know these answers, I think, again, then you can justify certain things in relation to Pollard.
Well, let's play it out for a minute.
Yeah.
You're Obama. You let Pollard out 2 years early. What are the implications?
I don't think there are any implications whatsoever at all. Again, because I don't know if people died or suffered as a consequence of Pollard's revelations, because I don't know that, my instincts tell me that he's been a long time in prison. He can't hurt anybody anymore. Whatever information he knows is outdated. And he may, in fact, have served a longer term than people who have done, from what I know, much worse damage in betraying the United States to the Soviet Union. Let him go. It also would be a very good goodwill gesture on the part of the American government to the state of Israel and would help Netanyahu come along on certain issues.
Now, the Israelis have been known to be very generous in prisoner releases to get one person away from, for example, Arab forces.
That's correct.
So they've 300 people.
That's correct.
I must say I'm at a loss on this one.
Most people are at a loss. But the point that you make is, and it's a very, very tough point in Israel now, men who have blood on their hands, who have killed Israelis, killed civilians. Now, I'm talking about soldiers. Some of them killed soldiers. Some have killed Israeli men, women, and children. They are being released. Certainly, the United States can release Pollard.
Talk to me, Stephen Berg, about anti-Semitism in the United States. You know, I'm sort of interested in this. We know it exists in other places, but I want to center in on this country. You know, I still feel it sometime. I'm wondering, is it better? Is it worse?
It's much better. Plato used to say, only the dead have seen the last of war. But you can say only dead Jews have seen the last of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism will be with us till the end of time. The question about anti-Semitism in America, in the United States, or anywhere else, is it of such a magnitude to impede the Jewish entrance into the mainstream of American life? And does it pose a threat, a physical threat, to the Jews in the United States? And the answer in both cases is no.
There's a lot of intermarriage happening in the United States.
There is a lot of intermarriage. You wouldn't have that great deal of intermarriage if there was so much anti-Semitism. In addition to that, I mean, look, can one imagine? They used to say there was a Jewish seat on the Supreme Court. Now, one-third, there are three Jews sitting on the Supreme Court. If the people in Florida, some of the older folks in Florida, knew how to vote, we would have had a Jewish vice president. We've had a Jewish secretary of state. We have Jews in the cabinet. Please don't misconstrue. The people outside who are listening should not misconstrue this. Only an idiot would deny the existence of anti-Semitism. Only an idiot would deny that. But it is not a major problem here. The other issue is the one that you alluded to, and that is assimilation, and that is the degree of intermarriage. That is a problem for the Jewish community, because it was once thought, years ago, intermarriage was not a problem, because at least half of the people who intermarried, Jews who intermarried, were raising their children as Jews. That figure, studies have shown, it's not true, it's not accurate. Now the figure they're talking about is 28% to 30%, which means that there will be a diminution in the number of Jews as we go forward.
I love having you here, Stephen Berg, but I wanted to talk to you about the book that you're working on right now about the civil rights movement. It's something that has fascinated me for years. We do know, I think we know, you know far more than I do, but that Jews played a very prominent part, at least in the beginning of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, it's one of the great chapters, a golden chapter in American Jewish history. The first president of the NAACP was a Jew. Jews were very close to Martin Luther King Jr. In the 1954 desegregation ruling by the Supreme Court, Jews were involved. It's Brown versus the Board of Education. But there's another Brown. There's Esther Brown, a middle-class Jewish housewife, who tells Mr. Brown, you don't have to take this stuff anymore. Participate. You know, we'll help you. There is, as every student of the Supreme Court knows, by those who supported the desegregation decision, it was felt that it had to be unanimous to have legitimacy within the American public. And the man who was most responsible for that is Felix Frankfurter, the man who held the Jewish seat on the Supreme Court. And that famous experiment, the black dolls and the white dolls, the money for that supported Kenneth Clark, the black psychologist, came from a Jewish organization. There was Stanley Levison. According to Taylor Branch and to Garrow, who are the best biographers of Martin Luther King, Stanley Levison was probably the most reliable professional, black or white, that Martin Luther King Jr. ever had. Harry Wachtel brought Martin Luther King to Wall Street. Marvin Rich, the great fundraiser for CORE. Out of the 1,000 people who went south, out of the whites who went south in the Mississippi summer of 1964, 30% to 40% were Jewish. And also, of course,
remembering at the time that less than 2% of the United States was Jewish.
Less than 2% of the American public was Jewish.
Yeah.
Of the Freedom Riders, close to 50% of the white Freedom Riders were Jewish. So a lot of the money that went to the civil rights movement came from Jews. And the blockbuster book of 1964, Crisis in Black and White by Charles Silverman, again, a committed Jew, and the one, the strangest of them all, the man that was more popular among Gentiles than he was among Jews, but he was a committed Jew, was Harry Golden, the editor of the Carolina, the publisher of the Carolina Israelite, who in a very subtle and comical way poked fun at segregation. And so all the way down the line, going back to the early years of the 20th century, Jews were instrumental in founding the Urban League, the first unions, the major unions that really reached out to black workers, the ILGWU, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. The Jewish record is a very, very good one.
Okay, so what happens?
What happens? Well, that's an interesting thing. What happens is a number of things, very, very quickly. The riots in 1965 in Harlem, Bedford-Stuyvesant, or in the 60s, in the middle of the 60s. These were anti-white riots, but in a number of cases, Jewish businessmen also suffered. In many areas, people don't realize this. One of the best books in American Jewish history is a book entitled When Harlem Was Jewish. Harlem used to be a Jewish enclave. The blacks move in, the Jews move out. But many Jews own the apartment houses. Many Jews own businesses there. And some of those Jewish-owned businesses will not hire blacks. So when the riots begin, it appears that Jews are being targeted. In most cases, the people being targeted are targeted because they're whites. In Watson, Rochester, and Bedford-Stuyvesant, and Harlem, and so on. But that antagonizes a number of Jews. Some people believe, look what we did, and now we're on the receiving end of black violence. The other things that are significant is that as we approach the June Day's War, the Six-Day War, a number of black leaders, Stokely Carmichael, for example, and some of the others.
I was going to bring him up. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, begin, first of all, with black power. Black power is not anti-Semitic. Black power, in many cases, was anti-white. And so a number of Jews who had played a major role in the civil rights movement, even in SNCC and in CORE, they are going to be thrown out of the movement. Not because they're Jews, but because they're whites. Some Jews get very upset about that. And many people do not understand what in fact happened in May of 67. In May of 67, as the Arabs began to mobilize against Israel and began to talk about destroying Israel, throwing the Jews into the sea, for many Jews, I can remember, we were frightened. We were very, very, this is going to be another Holocaust. Elie Wiesel tells a story, if I remember correctly, getting on a plane in Paris. He has survived the Holocaust. He's not going to survive another Holocaust. He's going to be in Israel when the Jews die. He gets on the plane, and who does he see? The plane is filled with Holocaust survivors who feel the same thing. So the mood, this is for the historian, you got it. It's always important to get back into the context of the times, the ethos of the times. The Jews are going to die again. Israel is going to be destroyed. And then when some black leaders, like Carmichael and a number of the others, when they side with the Arabs against the Jews, for a number of Jews, this is a betrayal. Then there's the teacher strike in New York in 1968. And then there are these two incidents, one in, I think, 79, and the other in the early 1980s. Andy Young, the most important African-American in the State Department,
UN
ambassador to the UN. Mm. This is the man that negotiates secretly with the Palestinians. Whether Carter told him he should do it, we don't know. But that was not American policy. There's an uproar by Israeli supporters. Does Carter dismiss him because of pressure coming from the Jewish community? Probably not. Carter dismissed him because he was violating American policy at that time, which was not to talk to the PLO. Some people in the African-American community thought that the Jews brought about the dismissal of this great black leader. Perception is everything. We know that. Then in the early 1980s, I think it was 82, but I'm not, the early 1980s, Jesse Jackson talks to an American reporter. And what does he say? He refers to New York City as Haimetown. That's not a nice thing to say. But if that's the worst thing people ever said about New York City or about Jews, it's sure not the end of the world. Jesse Jackson immediately apologized. Some Jews overreacted. And that led to the dissolving of the close ties. And then there was, more seriously, an issue that resonates right down to the present day. And that's the issue of affirmative action. For black people, for African Americans, affirmative action is a way to compensate for the terrible suffering that they had. You can make a very good case for that. No people have been discriminated against more than black people in the United States. Mm. But everybody brings to the table historical baggage. And what do Jews, most of whom come from American Jews who come from Eastern Europe, what do they see in affirmative action? They see a quota. After all, Jews living in the Russian Empire, where most of us come from, confronted what was called the numerus clausus, a quota system. Only a certain percentage of Jews could attend gymnasiums or high schools and universities. In interwar Poland, the numerus clausus often became a numerus nullus. No Jews in the medical schools. So the Jewish fear was, well, it discriminates against us. What we worry about is that proverbial slippery slope, some people said. If you begin to have a quota, certain percentage of black people or African Americans, Latinos or women should be in the universities, then someone's going to say, well, the Jews are only 2% of the American population. Only 2% of the people in medical schools should, in fact, be Jewish. That was the Jewish fear. That is affirmative action presents a problem, even though I have argued probably one of the primary beneficiaries of affirmative action are American Jewish women. That is, again, women benefited from affirmative action. If you want to get into college, you have to have graduated from high school. If you want to get into the medical schools and the law schools and the dental schools, you have to have graduated from college. And the result of the fact of the matter is, Jewish female graduation rates were probably higher than any other group in the United States. So Jewish women benefited. But some Jewish men in this country did suffer as a consequence of affirmative action.
Okay, so tracing it down, Stephen Burke, from this very interesting discussion, has the original rupture been repaired? Will it be repaired?
It's not the way that it used to be. There's too much blood under the bridge, for want of a better expression. There are conflicts over affirmative action. There are conflicts over the state of Israel. But in the end, it will never break because African Americans and Jews have two things in common. One is those who hate Jews hate African Americans. Those who hate African Americans hate Jews. We both have a common, let us say, platform, a common interest in defeating racism in the United States. That will keep us together. And the other is, you know what the old adage is about Jews? It's an interesting one, said by a frustrated Republican who is reputed to have said, these Jews are impossible. They look like Episcopalians, and they vote like Puerto Ricans. That is, Jews don't vote their pocketbook. Jews understand that a debilitated economy, an economy with high unemployment, is not good for the Jews. As the night follows the day, it will generate anti-Semitism. African Americans know a basic fact of life. Historically, the rate of black unemployment is twice the national average. So Jews and African Americans will stand together supporting policies that will prop up a weak economy. These are the two things that will make the Jews and the African Americans stand together. From a Jewish perspective, it is essential that the Jews, of course, maintain whatever good relations they can with the African American community and then reach out to other ethnic groups. That is, to Latinos, to Asian Americans, to evangelicals, to all people with whom they can share a common interest. That is the Jewish agenda, the part of the Jewish agenda domestically.
You work closely with Jewish federations and you speak with them and the rest. Is it your sense that those very commendable words which you've just issued are shared by the people who are working hard to create a Jewish identity in this polyglot, this country?
I think they are. Those who are making the decisions, and for large numbers of Jews, there's an awareness, one, Israel has to be supported. Two, Jews abroad have to be supported. The only thing that stands between elderly Jews and starvation in the former Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe is the money that is provided by the federations through the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. In addition to that, they understand assimilation is a problem here, and there are now outreach programs by many federations in large cities to these other groups, Latinos, Asian Americans, African Americans, and so on. The relationship is a good one. This is, the old statement is the Yiddish statement about America. It is the golden Medina. It is the golden land. It remains the golden land for the overwhelming majority of American Jews.
Well, Stephen Burke, I can't wait to read the book. It's a fascinating area. It's one I've always been interested in. And when the book is published, I want you to come back and talk to us some more about it. You know, Stephen Burke, professor, you're always welcome here. Always. It's always been great to have you and to understand in the dialogue that goes on how important it is that we hear all sides of every story. We've been talking with Stephen Burke, Henry and Sally Schaefer, professor of Holocaust and Jewish Studies and professor of history at Union College at Schenectady, New York. Professor, thanks so much for joining us today. The door is always open.
Thank you very much.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.